Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Dalitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy. My name is Matthew Dalitz, and I'm here with my indispensable friend, Richard Hill. Hi, Richard.
I'm glad to be indispensable. I feel like a dispenser already. Fantastic. How are you going, Matt?
I'm doing okay.
Brilliant.
Richard, today we're heading over to the east coast of the United States to talk to Courtney Armstrong.
Ah, yes, gorgeous. Yep. Courtney. She's fantastic. I like her very much. She's written for the magazine a few times and really like her stuff.
She has. She's written for the magazine a little while ago when she released her first book, 10 Strategies for Getting Your Clients Unstuck. But now she's got a new book out on the market. It's Rethinking Trauma Treatment. And so we thought we'll get her on the show and we'll find out what this is all about.
Yeah, because she's talking about one of our, you and I often talk about as one of the most important aspects of our capacity to improve our mental health, which is memory reconsolidation.
That's right. This is a favorite topic of ours. And so we're really glad that Courtney is talking about that and she has made that a core part of her therapy practice. So let's go across to the US and have a chat to Courtney. Courtney Armstrong, welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah. Hi, Richard here. How you doing?
Great. I love you guys. Love listening to your podcast. I've learned a lot and you're very entertaining. So.
Oh, good.
Well, that's the end of our show. We've had our positive comment. We'll leave now. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. What a wonderful show. Thank you, Courtney, for being on the show.
Thanks, Courtney. We appreciate it. It's nice to know. And we're getting some lovely comments from people around. And, you know, we just hope people listen to the show and you know, share it with their friends. Let's go viral. It'd be fantastic.
Yeah, I think this whole thing started where Richard and I were just talking about, we were having such great conversations. We thought, wow, some others should eavesdrop on these great conversations that we have together and with other people that were writing for our magazine. And all of a sudden, we've got a podcast.
Fantastic.
Now, we've been talking a bit about the brain and what we do and our memory and our how we pull it together. And Courtney does some fantastic work on this.
She does. Courtney has been in our magazine in the past, and just recently, she's released a new book, Rethinking Trauma Treatment. So I thought it would be fantastic if we get her on the show and talk about this new book and some of her approaches to treatment, which will involve our favorite subject of memory reconsolidation.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
So tell us a bit about the book, Courtney. Now, this is with Norton, which are good friends of ours as well.
Yes.
So, and that's fantastic that you got accepted to write this book with them. Is there any process that went through? What are the excitement about it for you? Because it's a bit of a shift for you in some respects.
It is. You know, I wrote a book a few years ago called The Therapeutic Aha. And what inspired that book actually was the topic that we're going to talk about today, memory reconsolidation. And in that book, what I really elaborated on is that the key to change is to reach the emotional brain, which speaks in a different language from our prefrontal cortex. It learns through experience. And so what prompted me to write the Therapeutic Aha was talking to therapists at some conferences about engaging the emotional brain and some creative techniques that we could all use to help people really feel the change, not just think differently, but really feel differently about things. And then the feedback I got, great feedback from the book, but people really wanted more on how to use this to work with trauma. And what I was actually surprised because I thought there's so many books out there on trauma and I didn't think Norton would want another book on trauma. And they said, no, actually, we would love to have another book on trauma. And so what I wanted to do with this book is address those harder cases when people have complex trauma. And I wanted to give people specific tools that I've seen work with different kinds of trauma, like sexual trauma, childhood abuse, and whatnot for different clients. So my clients over the years have taught me certain imagery, scripts, metaphors, music, and movement techniques that they were telling me had helped them more than any other therapy they'd ever tried for their trauma. So the other piece I address in that book is attachment issues, because so often, you know, we know we know we have to attune with our clients, but different attachment styles require different ways of connecting and attuning. And so I know that you've had some other people on or in Shrink Up Radio's interviewed Daniel Brown on that recently. Mm. So we decided what we want to talk about was memory reconsolidation, because that's really what a lot of the book's about, how you do that, how you actually update those old beliefs and learnings for people who've been through so much trauma that they have trouble trusting it. You know, they're like, that's a nice thought, but I don't believe it'll work for me, or I don't believe my life can change because it's always been like this. And I have found they do really well when we explain the process of memory reconsolidation and collaborate with them to create a new experience that causes them to believe what they want to believe.
Yeah, fantastic. So can we dive straight into the very core of what is creating the transformational change? Now, for those that are listeners, if you've tracked with us for any amount of time, you will know that, you know, we're very excited about memory reconsolidation. And before the show, Courtney, we were talking about how amazed we are that still there's not enough therapists out there that know about what this transformational process is, what it's all about. And so you've got a great acronym to help us remember some of the steps. So can you let us know what is that acronym and what are some of these steps?
Yeah. So, and you guys, this is, I'm like Bruce Ecker. I believe any effective therapy can elicit memory reconsolidation. But what I saw is the same five steps in any effective therapy when it elicits memory reconsolidation. So the first step is R, which is recall the memory briefly, or recall the experience that is associated with the whatever belief the client wants to change. And we know from memory reconsolidation, the first thing you have to do to change a memory is take it out of storage. So you simply ask them to just recall it briefly. The second step, and I think this is one of the most critical, is to explore, I call it a step E, explore embodied beliefs, or in other words, explore implicit beliefs, meaning beliefs that you associated with that event that feel true, even if you intellectually know they're not true. Mm-hmm. So I simply ask these three questions to get those beliefs. I say, what did it feel like this event meant about you? What did it feel like it meant about other people? And what did it feel like it meant about the world? And if you just ask it that directly, they will pop out it'll be quick. They can identify them very quickly. Then the next step that a lot of therapies don't talk about, that I consider still part of exploring beliefs, is explore their desired beliefs. What do you want to believe instead? So if they say, I believed it was my fault, and they might say, intellectually, I know it really wasn't. So what I would do is I help them figure out, what do you want to believe instead, that it felt that way then, but now I know this about that situation. So I want to believe that more fully now, that I was just caught up in this crazy situation doing the best I could to survive, for example, might be what the desired belief is. And we'll talk about that more when we go into examples. And then from that, when I get what their desired belief is, what they want to believe instead about themselves, other people in the world, then step three is C, create a new meaning experience, or what Bruce Ecker calls a mismatch experience. Right. So I call it a new meaning experience with my clients, because that just makes more sense to them. And I'll say, so what we want to do is create an experience that causes you to feel the way you want to feel. And I explain to them, we can do that with imagery, music, or movement, because your emotional brain is the part of your brain that we're going to work with in this step, and it has to feel it to believe it. So usually I explore first. So when you think about feeling, so this is just a simple technique most of us learned in hypnosis and other trauma therapies you may have learned, just the future self. I'll just say, when you think about how you want to be feeling about this event instead of how you have been feeling, let's create a model or future you. And I may have to help them start, but I think about, what would he or she have to feel in order to realize this wasn't their fault? So I might paint the picture first, describe it, and again, we'll get into examples in a minute, so I don't bog listeners down too much in the details yet. But I'd usually start with like kind of, we outline their future self, and then we figure out what will help them step into that feeling. And that's the fun part. Then step four is objectively describe the memory while integrating that new meaning experience. In other words, I just have them know, I want you to tell me the story again, but just describing it. And as you know, we know from hypnosis or NLP training, if you're trained in that, it's like what we've learned about watching it on a movie screen. Like, don't relive it, like objectively describe the event. But then I ask them to change how the event ends or the meaning of it as they're describing it based on what we just did in step three, with we created a new experience. And that's where I really see the magic happen. And I think that's because that's when we're directly juxtaposing the old memory against the new experience. And that's usually where I see the shift. And then step five, I call new narrative integration, which is simply continuing to have them repeat the story or integrating new experiences until that new meaning feels true. And most of the time I found it only takes a few times, like going through the story, maybe two or three more times. And then they'll tell me it just changed. I that's so weird. I don't feel the same way anymore. And so what I wanted to talk about with you guys is how we create those new meaning experiences. I think that's really the key.
So before we go there, let me just recap. So the acronym is RECON, R-E-C-O-N. It's recall the memory, briefly, don't need to go into depth. Explore the undesired beliefs or emotional learnings. Create a new meaning or experience. Objectively describe the memory. And then you've got the new narrative integration. So if anyone's taking notes, RECON.
RECON, Thank you. I was just looking at that too, yeah.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you for simplifying that.
Before we go into some examples, so we can make this really concrete for people, the thing that really strikes me when we're talking about implicit emotional memories, it is emotional, right? So the key word that you kept saying again and again was emotion. So how did it feel? You know, what was the feeling? So this is very, very different to, you know, sort of the higher order, you know, cognitive rational thinking. Well, it's not talking about, well, that's not rational, you know, that doesn't make sense. No, it's all about what do you feel, because it's the feeling that is driving, is underlying the problematic behavior or feelings, right?
You're spot on. And thank you for bringing that to everyone's attention, that it's I'm very specific. What did it feel like it meant? Don't, if you ask what they think, you're talking to the wrong part of the brain. Because the rational mind will make up an answer, you know, for that. So when you ask what did it feel like, they understand, well, here's how it felt, even though I know that's probably irrational. You know, you're more likely to get the real implicit belief that's been, you know, encoded there.
Yeah. So you've got a lot of great and very different ideas and techniques that you use to create this new experience and to sort of embed that down into those deeper brain regions, right? Give us some examples.
So the easiest thing to do, like I had alluded to earlier, is imagery. And when I talk about imagery, it's just not just visual. It can involve all the senses, but it's accessible to most people, and it's a simple way to start. So I'll often say, so we'll take an example of a client of mine who had been through a pretty brutal sexual assault. It was in a workplace setting, and she kept questioning herself, like, what could I have done to prevent that? Because it was an acquaintance, and she thought, how did I not see this coming? So she kept blaming herself, and I asked her what she wanted to believe instead. She said, I want to believe that I did what I could do. There's no way that I could have known that this would happen, and that I handled the situation in the best way possible. And to believe that I'll be okay. Like, I can date and have relationships again after this. And then I said, so when you think about your mind working that way, what qualities would you associate with that? Like, clear, strong, you know, and she said, yeah, I feel like I would be logical, strong, insightful, you know, clear that I'm okay. I didn't cause that. And I said, and when you think about your mind working that way, let's get a symbol, something in nature or an animal in the wild that would symbolize your mind working in the desired way. And she said, an oak tree. And this is often how clients will say it when you ask for a metaphor or a symbol, something will pop up. It works for 99% of my clients. A symbol would pop up and I'll say, well, so tell me what you associate with oak tree. And she goes, I don't know. I just, all of a sudden, I hadn't thought about this before, but I remembered this oak tree that's in our neighborhood that is the only tree that survived these tornadoes that came through our town several years ago. And I don't know why, it just popped into my mind, like, you know, that I can survive a storm just like that tree, and that I didn't cause this, just like the tree didn't cause the storm. Like, all of a sudden she could see all these parallels, and that symbol became really meaningful to her. And then what I did is just asked her to see her symbol, and I just kind of guided it like a guided imagery, just guiding her to really step in and feel like the tree, just so she could feel what she wanted to believe, not just think it.
Yeah.
And so that can work really well for a lot of people. And as I talked about before, even if symbolic imagery, you know, doesn't strike you, just even inviting them to imagine their future self, like, how do you want to feel 3 years from now? And just let's just play for a minute. Like, don't worry about right now, whether you just, let's just step into it. And what do you imagine it would be like, and really take them into that. And when you do that, I believe it turns on that new learning in the emotional brain, or that a new option, let me say it that way. And I think that's what can trigger reconsolidation, because it's like the emotional brain goes, oh, I've never thought about an oak tree when I've been in this story before, or I've never thought about myself feeling like that. That's interesting. I think it grabs the emotional brain's attention and opens up that reconsolidation window.
Yeah, no, this is fabulous. And the issue that what I work with a lot is curiosity. I work with the internal self-organizing systems and all the sort of stuff that we're talking about here. But one of the really big things I think to point out here is that here we are in this modern world, with this first world, everything's around us. We've got certain conditions that we've socially become adapted to that we think are normal. And they're absolutely abnormal, because all the stuff you're talking about is actually how our system has the social societies that our system has evolutionarily developed with. And you go and say what you just said to perhaps an indigenous tribe, in American Indians or in Aboriginals, and say, oh, well, we did a visualization and we imagined what your totem spirit would be. And they go, yeah, well, that's what we do all the time. What do you guys do? And they say, well, we go down the street and we hope someone's got a book or a workshop or a new thing that's going to save us. So this dissociation, one of the problems and difficulties we have in our modern culture is this dissociation from our capacity to actually resolve our own issues through things that are not literal. So it's very difficult. The brain does it. I mean, in my notes, I put down here, how do neurons reorganize themselves? And we can discuss that in a sec. But what stimulates or triggers the confidence? Don't want to anthropomorphize to neurons. But the confidence in neurons to consolidate themselves in a different way from the existing structure and architecture that they had developed. And the biggest lack of confidence that we have is, exactly what you said before, I could never be like that. And you think, oh, you idiot, of course you were. Think back to, like, you're the same as when you were a baby. Don't be silly. You've been doing it all your life. So, and this beautiful thing of... of just metaphor as one mechanism, because some people aren't visual, so there's other things that they do. They might do it with music, they might do it with movement, as you've already suggested. So that's enough for me. But I just, you know, get excited. I
get so excited. That's why I was so excited to talk to you guys, because I really want to hear your thoughts on this too, you know?
Yeah.
And I know Matt and I have talked about music, and you both are musicians. And that was one of the pieces I wrote about, I think, for the magazine a few years ago, that some of my clients who weren't visual, I would say, or is there a song? Is there a song that would help you step into how you want, that can pull up that feeling for you, the one that you want to have? Mm-hmm. And one of the most memorable was a client of mine who had suffered pretty brutal childhood abuse. And he said, "Rearview Mirror, Pearl Jam," like instantly he knew. And so when we did recon, you know, I'd asked him to recall one memory from his one abuse memory, explored the beliefs he attached to it and what he wanted to believe instead. And he's just said, "I just want to believe that I'm, you know, that's behind me. Like, I know my stepdad was messed up. I don't need to carry that with me. I mean, I'm done with it. You know, I just want to move forward." Mm-hmm. And when he pulled up that song, and then we listened to that song for step three, instead of guiding him through an imagery, he pulled it up on his phone. We listened to it together. And I said, "Get into it, because this is the trick." I said, you've got to feel it with as much of your being as you can, to get your emotional brain to grab it and integrate it into this old memory. And we had a great time doing it.
Yeah, I think it's really important that people appreciate that a neuron pathway that has built itself up as a protective mechanism to enable you to potentially have a more safe existence tomorrow is not going to give that up just because of a flippity-flap idea. No. Neuronal pathways take a certain amount of convincing, and you've just described the type of convincing that it needs. It needs to be cognitive. It needs to be, and we can go through all the the parts of the brain, but it needs to be visceral, and there's lots of other aspects. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so when it comes to music, the visceral and the feeling part, the evoking of the emotion is huge, right? And it's something that you feel. It's something that only exists in the passage of time. And so we literally move with the emotion when it comes to music. So yeah, very powerful tool.
And yes.
And when we're talking about memory reconsolidation, just to remind listeners that the amazing thing here is that when we have a memory that reconsolidates, it is that memory that might have been problematic in the past, but it is the memory itself is changing. It's not, we're not setting up an opposing thought or emotion that's sort of in conflict and going to battle and try and win out the emotional, you know, battle in your brain.
It's not a conditioning. It's a reconsolidating. That's right. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And so once it's reconsolidated, then your emotional memory is what it is. You can't evoke the same yuck feeling that you had in the past.
Yes. Yes. And thank you for reiterating that, because that's what's so fascinating to me and my clients. And your client, you know, all of our clients, when they experience this, they will say, "I can't feel the old way anymore." Like,
that's
the
right.
Story literally changed. The way that it's encoded literally changes for them. And it's so beautiful, because it's such a relief for them, and it doesn't have to be painful, and they don't have to relive the memory.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's another important thing to just highlight too, that it may not be one process of reconsolidation, like an onion. I mean, I've got a lovely client, and we've had amazing, amazing breakthroughs, total life changing, and then a month later saying, "Oh, I've got a new one now." So, in other words, there's often a complex of associations and reconsolidations that can be required. Because we build on top, and we may even find that the thing that we're worried about now, which, for example, a phobia or something of the sort, and we can clear the phobia in a variety of ways, everywhere from NLP to hypnotism to other beautiful type of recon work and so on and so forth. And then someone says, "Oh, but now I've got this."
Right.
And we keep building things to protect ourselves. And over a lifetime, you can have quite a lot of layers. And I think with my client, we've got about 17 layers. And I think we're pretty clear now. She hasn't come back to me in a few months, so she must be pretty good.
Well, see, I'm so glad that you're saying that, because this is the other thing that I wanted to emphasize in the book on rethinking trauma treatment, that even though we have much better understanding and tools for helping people, that I know this happened to me when I learned EMDR and when I learned you had Mary Ellen Bowles on recently, and I also got trained in rapid resolution therapy and love some of those creative techniques. And what I noticed is that for some people, it would work very quickly. And then other people, particularly people who had multiple events or complex trauma, there were so many aspects to the events that there were several emotional learnings. So we might only work on one learning at a time. You know, for example, in sexual abuse, we may work with their feelings about what happened in the actual abuse, but then we'd have a separate series of sessions just working with beliefs about their family and how their family responded or didn't respond. That was another piece of the trauma that was, you know, that had a whole different complex, as you said, Richard, that needed to be addressed differently.
Yeah, that single element might have a number of facets, and each facet needs to be dealt with in order and rather as best we can. Yes, sorry, Matt.
Yes, yeah, and just to reassure your clients, I think to reassure them, like, this doesn't need to be a one and done. It's just we know the process that will lead to healing and reconsolidation, but you know the way we get there is very individual.
And that knowing the process is very important, isn't it? Because if we're left on our own, generally, because of what we call the consistency principle, the brain will look for evidence to confirm what it already knows, what it already feels, right? So we're talking about music before. So, you know, if you've been hurt in a relationship, you will naturally, you know, you gravitate to the really sad songs about breakups and make you feel even worse. And instead of reconsolidation, you're consolidating the memory, that emotional memory, and making it even stronger.
Yes, you're reconsolidating you can reconsolidate the same thing. That's right, and make it even worse. That's right, Matt. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So understanding how we need to create this, what Bruce Eckert calls the juxtaposition, is so important, and to have a therapist that knows what they're doing in that area is so valuable. I imagine people could read a book and attempt this on by themselves, but I think having a professional that, you know, knows the process and can talk people through is so very important.
Well, I think that's a good point there, Matt, because a lot of people do it. The issue of course, if you're not able, if you're not finding it happening spontaneous in your life, then for goodness sake, go get some help. We're supposed to be an interpersonal species.
Right.
And but there's just another thing that's really important is the timing of this. Who wants to jump in on the technical aspect? Courtney, are you in?
Yes. And, you know, this is something that I know the neuroscientists, like we had talked together earlier, when I first learned about memory reconsolidation, it was through a conversation with Joe Ledoux, neuroscientist in New York University. And at that time, which was, I think, 2010, they were still thinking that you had to recall the memory and wait about 10 minutes and then do like a new experience or a mismatch experience. And then other scientists, you know, through more and more research. And then I think Bruce Eckers articulated it really nicely that it's more the juxtaposition of the mismatch experience starts the clock ticking for reconsolidation. Well, and then you have five or six hours. What do you guys, what's your understanding?
With mice was about 3 to 4 hours. And what we're talking about is the fact that what we call the neuronal set of connections become labile. And I love it. It actually sounds like a bit of a sex show, but it's not. But labile, it just means that the connections that exist when recalled will move apart for a brief period of time. Now, as you can imagine, from an evolutionary point of view and a development of a mental, socially developing species, this is a really useful thing to evolve, because if you had fixed states constantly and you constantly had to rebuild what you were saying, Matt, competitive states, our brain would be, we'd need a bigger brain just to survive till we were five. So the fact that we can actually remove our perceptions of the fact that we are dependent children on a larger adult, and then just and then reconsolidate the thing into a different pattern of, oh, now I'm an independent person and I no longer need those dependencies, is a brilliant piece of self-organization and reorganization of brain functioning.
Yeah, brilliant. Courtney, I'm wondering, just very briefly, have you got some case studies that you could sort of just give us some an idea of the sort of people that you've, I know you, we had one earlier on, but some, maybe some different ones where you've worked in a different way.
Yeah, a couple of short and sweet ones.
Yeah. So one, I think I'll share one of my clients who had combat trauma, and he was stationed in Afghanistan. Well, actually, no, this person was in Iraq. And they were going out on a mission and knew that they were going to be buried, improvisational explosive devices, IEDs. And he was in a Humvee behind another Humvee where his commanding officer was in the first Humvee, and he was very close to his commanding officer. And that Humvee, his commanding officer's Humvee, ran over an IED. And so he saw this happen. The men were ejected from the vehicle because due to the impact, and the vehicle rolled over on his commanding officer's legs. And so my client was in the back of the Humvee that he was in. He was in the gunner's position and he couldn't move. He couldn't get down. He couldn't, the man driving the vehicle had passed out. And so what he explained to me he was stuck with is he could hear his commanding officer screaming in horrific pain. And he felt like completely helpless. I can't do anything. He's going to die and I can't do anything to save him. And what he told me as he was telling me this was the main memory he wanted me to help him with, he said, the military lost a wonderful man that day. And said this, so then I asked him before I started to think about his beliefs about himself. I said, what are your beliefs about what happens after people die? Because I wanted to have some sense of his spiritual beliefs before we start kind of playing with potential new beliefs. And he said, I believe they go to heaven. And I said, so do you believe your commanding officer is in heaven? And he looked at me and he said, no. And I said, well, where do you think he is? He said, oh, he's in Texas, which is one of our U.S. states. And I said, well, what's he doing in Texas? And he said, well, he lives there. And I said, he didn't die? And he goes, well, no, he didn't die. And I said, and so what I love telling that story, because this is a beautiful example of how that implicit memory, when he was in the middle of it, the story ended there.
Right.
Now, later, his brain acquired new information when he said eventually he did get the driver of the vehicle to come back to consciousness, and they got medevac on the phone, and then the medevac took his commanding officer away, and for months he didn't know what had really happened to him. He just knew he was in ICU, but what he ended up telling me, he goes, well, yeah, he didn't die. That's what I'm telling you. That's why I love this man so much. He said he's living in Texas and he did lose his legs, but he's got three prosthetics. He's got one for playing basketball, one set for running, and one set for everyday activities. And he wants me to come visit him this summer, and I want to be able to play basketball with him, but I'm a wreck. I can't even function, you know? And so this was an interesting, I think this is interesting for all of us to look at, because his mind had one network that had this other part of what happened to this man, but it wasn't linked up to, you know, which is what I guess EMDR would call adaptive information processing, right? So to what we went through the recon process, but to create the new experience, I invited him to just imagine him going to visit his commanding officer and seeing that he was okay, and he wanted my client to be okay. Like, he didn't want any guilt he didn't want this guy to feel any remorse or guilt about what he did, you know, and I just got him to imagine like a conversation they could have and maybe even playing basketball just to show his mind, hey, here's another possibility here. Here's another outcome, you know, for this story. And then once I had him vividly imagine that possibility, I mean, he already started feeling lighter and like, you know, yeah, that's right. You know, does his commanding officer want his legs back? Well, sure he does. So I don't want to Pollyanna it. So I don't want your listeners to think I'm just like, and everybody lived happily ever after. I mean, when I'm doing this with clients, I'm also very real with them. Like, you know, I know this guy would rather have his legs back, but for him to be able, I mean, I think what you want, it sounds like, is to make this story about like resilience and triumph and honor and, you know, what you learned there and what you've learned through the relationship with this person. And he's like, yeah. And I said, so now retell the story, speaking to me from that realization, from that place, that this is what the story is going to be about now.
Yeah.
And you guys, we reconsolidated that memory in one session. I couldn't believe it.
Absolutely. And what's beautiful, Courtney, is I'm sitting here and I'm listening to all these different therapeutic techniques being emerging spontaneously out of what is a fundamental understanding of what is necessary in the brain. So there's some narrative going on there. There's some EMDR going on in there. There's some metaphor stuff going on in there. So one of my big things is therapies are great, but they are just they're different facets of the same thing. And you just keep opening up the possibility to your client. Because what do we want to do? We want their memory to reconsolidate in a more productive, effective, and beneficial way. What else? What? Just beneficial. There's nothing else to it.
You are a thank you, because that's a big piece of what I talk about when I talk about my book and my trainings is be in it. I integrate all over the place. You know, use, because different clients are going to respond to different things. So I'm always just exploring with the client, what would make sense for them, what resonates with them. And I go with, you know, it's very collaborative.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. It's wonderful. Beautiful, isn't it, Matt? Yeah. It's lovely to see.
Absolutely. Well, I'm just conscious of the time. And I think that's a good place.
It's a great story to finish on. Yeah.
Finish on. Yeah. Courtney, any final words that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think, you know, I'm excited. A lot of people, when they first hear about this, they think, oh, that sounds really complicated. I don't think I can do it. You're probably doing it in your sessions without realizing it. So please, I think I want people to feel more comfortable exploring these processes with your clients. And I think what really can help is whenever they bring up something traumatic, you know, to listen and provide the empathy that we were taught to do. But I think just exploring what would you like to believe about it instead starts opening that up, and you would be surprised at what just that one question can reveal.
Yep. And for the therapist to have confidence that what you're doing is actually, you know, scientifically validated. It's something that makes real transformational change.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the important thing. Absolutely. This knowledge doesn't make people's brains reconsolidate. What this knowledge does is it allows you as the therapist and the client, if they choose to be engaged in the theory, have this increased degree of confidence. And that is another reason why the neurons will have the confidence to reconsolidate. So it's pretty cool. Yeah.
Right.
Wonderful. Courtney Armstrong, thank you so much for being on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast.
Yes, thank you.
It was great to have you here, and looking forward to actually some more articles in our magazine from you.
Yes, more articles. We'll talk about that.
Talk about that. I'd love to. And I don't know when this will air, but I will be doing some workshops in Australia in September through Tatra. So if people are interested in that, we can, you know, I'll work with you guys to get that information.
Send us the details and we'll put it in the show notes. No problem.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Courtney.
All right. Okay. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was great, Matt. Wasn't
absolutely.
It? That story, those case studies, you know, I'm thinking of some of mine. I'm sure you were thinking of some of yours.
Yeah.
There's so many in different aspects and different treatments that I used, but I know that it's the memory reconsolidation process, which is the one which is or one of the ones that is having the effect. It's a really important process to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that last story too. And that made me think, you know, of, I think it was Daniel Kahneman that was talking about, you know, finishing stories right at the height of the worst part, and you keep reconsolidating that memory and it just gets worse and worse. Yeah. Whereas if you carry the story through, you know, to some sort of resolution, then you're going to reconsolidate that memory in a much better way.
Yeah, and it's difficult. We have to remember that neurons don't know they're supposed to do anything different other than what we set them up for. It's not like they're sitting there saying, oh, hey, Richard, there's the rest of the stories over there. A neuron fires. When a neuron fires, it fires. That's all there is to it. We have to organize the nature of the way in which they fire based on our experience. And that's what therapy is. It's an experiential opportunity to reframe our neurons.
Woo-hoo! Absolutely. Okay, so fantastic conversation. So thank you, everybody, for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. Looking forward to catching up with you next week.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.